Welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. A sacrifice zone is a place where dangerous pollution, waste, and undesirable impacts of urban living are deposited, creating a myth that the land is not valuable and that no one of importance lives there. Over the past 70 or so years, vast tracts of North and Northwest Portland have been transformed from what was once a series of thriving river, wetland, and forest communities into an industrial sanctuary. In other words, a sacrifice zone. Today we talk with Sarah Taylor, a longtime resident of the Linton neighborhood and an advocate for the lost history of Portland's Sacrifice Zone. Sarah, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi.
Well, many years ago when I first moved to Portland, I thought I'd move to paradise, but I was puzzled by this one area of town when I'd go out on Highway 30, St. Helens Road, and on one side was this beautiful forest up in the hills, and on the other side were a bunch of tank farms and weird industry, and it was kind of scary, and I couldn't figure out how those two very disparate landscapes were juxtaposed. And then I kind of got used to it, as most Portlanders do. And I didn't start thinking about it again until a number of years ago when I was, well, first of all, aware that this was a very seismically active zone and wondered what would happen if those oil and gas tanks were to be ruptured by an earthquake. So let's talk a little bit about how that disparate landscape got started. And it's actually, you live right kind of in the midst of all that.
Yeah, I actually lived in Linton and didn't really know the history as well. And then all of a sudden, that history began to come to me. And through a series of like research and conversations with local people, I began to understand that history better. And of course, that area was, as you said, it was the confluence of two great rivers, many, many lakes, Smith and Bybee, Giles, Doan, many creeks, Balch Creek being one of the most famous. And this was an area that was always a working waterfront. So the big thing that people want to say is we need working waterfronts. So if you were to talk to the Grand Ronde tribe, they would tell you that was always a working waterfront. It was a busy transportation hub of different canoes, and it was a fishing ground. It was a place where people could gather, and also where there were many, many like wild ducks and geese. So it was a rich area, and it was used, and it was busy. It then, of course, was given or stolen through a land grant system. And we begin to think about, like, you know, covered wagons and our Oregon Trail unit. And we love to study, like, all the little covered wagons. And indeed, covered wagons did come down the Columbia and land in that area, and they often camped. But the land grant system, and I didn't even know this till recently, investors came from the East Coast. These weren't people in covered wagons who just came and got their little piece of land to farm. Those people came later. But the big people in this piece of land who are famous, Giles, Cooch, you know, the names we know, Balch, they got 500, 600 acres, not to make their own little farm, but to invest in, to resell, and to industrialize.
They came before or after the pioneers in the covered wagons?
Well, a little bit before, whenever you could get land, but they got big chunks of land, and their goal was to make a fortune, not necessarily to settle in Portland. Some of them did and some of them didn't. But they were industrial giants from the East Coast who wanted to bring that industrial flavor and make a lot of money. So it's kind of this myth.
Now they came, Portland was already settled. I'm assuming this is after 1859 and Oregon is a state and Portland is a city?
No. They came before that. So one thing that's important to understand is that Albina, St. John's, Linton were all their own towns. They were their own legal towns. And Albina was huge, way bigger than Portland, went all the way up to the Columbia River. Portland annexed, by 1915, they had annexed Linton, St. John's, and Albina. And as soon as they annexed those properties, they began to use them as sacrifice zones. So it happened very quickly. Portland said, we're running out of space. We need a place for our sewer. We need a place for our garbage. We need a place for industrial railroads and docks. And so they quickly annexed these properties and then began to tear those communities apart.
I'm kind of curious because I live in the other end of town, which was also a separate town, Selwood, and it was annexed into the city of Portland around 1900, I believe. And the history there that I've heard is, well, Selwood didn't have any roads. It had no way to get into Portland besides a boat. I did have electricity because it was closer to the Oregon City electrical power station than Portland was. But other than that, it was kind of in the wilderness. And so the residents of Selwood eagerly became annexed to Portland. At least that's the myth. But I'm curious why Selwood didn't become a sacrifice zone, and instead it was North Portland that did.
I don't exactly know, except that probably North Portland was at the confluence of the Columbia and the Willamette. And then there was also a history of Fort Vancouver and trading. So it kind of had that history. So that's all I can think of, or that the people that started that wanted it to be that way. Now, you have to remember, those towns then became, they became immigrant manufacturing and shipping zones. So you go from the indigenous communities, and the indigenous people still did live in the area. That's a myth that they, you know, and they're thriving today. So they were then doing shipping, and they had businesses, and they lived. So if you look at Linton, you look at St. John's, you look at Albina, and you even look at like the Stumptown area, you saw housing, you know, low-income housing that was scattered around the river. And what we're looking at now is that area was torn down. So in Linton, you have the box factory. You had the wheat industry in Albina. You had these manufacturing immigrant communities, and they were torn down to make room for what I call a petrol industrial complex. So they tore down again. So we've had several tear downs.
So when did this all start?
Well, it appears to me that it started full blast, if you were to look at the history, around World War II. So what we know is that there were immigrant communities, but we had a Chinese Exclusion Act, and we had an African American Exclusion Act in Portland. What we know is that Giles Lake, which was the largest lake in the area, near where Montgomery Ward is, and going quite a large lake, was a Chinese farming community, and that all of their farms and houses were burnt down by the Ku Klux Klan. So early on, we have people trying to get rid of immigrant communities. So then you have World War II, you have an influx of immigrant communities coming in to work in the shipyards. We have African Americans coming to work in the shipyards. And we have housing projects built. The famous one, of course, is Vanport. And then we have Giles Lake. So Giles Lake became a 50,000-person housing project.
So this kind of goes back to another fascination that I have. Actually, I was just looking at this map I have called Portland's Disappearing Streams, or Disappeared Streams. And that whole area, I mean, all of the west side of the Willamette River was an immense wetland, down, including underneath the Markham Bridge. And I've got really familiar with like the wetlands that disappeared, and they're all paved over now around the south part of Portland. But I understand that you were sort of describing that in northwest Portland, there were these huge lakes. And the only one that you named that I think is still there is Smith and Bybee Lake. What happened to Giles Lake and some of these other really, I'm imagining, kind of Smith and Bybee Lakes on a much grander scale?
Well, they started to fill them in for industrial purposes. The Port of Portland filled them in. People, businessmen, different people wanted to fill in that lake. And of course, it's famous for the Lewis and Clark expedition, where they kind of spruced it up and then they proceeded to try to fill it in. And Port of Portland also wanted to dredge the river. So none of what's happening now in terms of climate change and our contribution could have happened if they hadn't filled in the west side of the river. So they start filling it in. And then what happens is World War II comes. They change the channel of the Willamette River, and they start building ships for the war, and that became this huge thing. So one of the housing projects, the second largest after Vanport, was Giles Lake. 10,000 African Americans lived on the other side of the railroad track. So what's important to know is that all that housing was torn down for unsold to petroleum companies. Even though the federal government said, we'll give you money to improve that housing and to keep that as affordable housing. So if you look at Albina, you look at Giles Lake, you look at Linton, what you see is a tear down of, I bet, 100,000 affordable homes that were just torn down in the, in those areas for so that, petroleum.
So that area now that's a huge sea of oil and gas tank farms, is that was actually housing?
Large parts of it were housing. And hotels and ferries and businesses and farms. The Toyota yard was a raspberry farm. I mean, this was people's businesses. So it was a working waterfront. And I think people in North Portland love a working waterfront. But what we feel like is that we have a choice between petroleum that is poisoning our water through the Superfund, all the poisoning of the water, poisoning our air, poisoning our children, or to have the condominiums just march up the waterfront. And I think what people want is to go back to having an active, healthy, working waterfront with affordable housing.
Well, I have this feeling when I go through Linton, which is one of my favorite parts of Portland, that I'm going into the past, and it's like I'm sort of looking through this scope, and I'm just seeing little bits, and if I kind of extrapolate, I can imagine what the rest of it was like. So let's talk about what's still there and what the rest of it was. I mean, I think of like what's left of Linton is basically Linton Feed and Seed Store.
Yeah. And I of course, have fought some for Linton. And one thing to remember is that the sacrifice zone or industrial sanctuary is next to Forest Park. So Forest Park runs the length of this. And some people want to think it's Washington Park, but it actually goes all the ways out to like Cornelius Pass. So we have highly flammable tanks, trains, trucks, right next to what we value in our city. So we certainly, Linton is in Forest Park. So we are kind of the caretakers of Forest Park. That's what I like to say. We have trails, many, many trails. And so we're kind of pushed up against Forest Park. And then we had the river with manufacturing. So what's left of Linton is very little. ODOT decided to bulldoze it down. And what you'll see, whether it's Albina, St. John's, or the west side, is you'll see that if it wasn't petroleum, it was highways. So you see petroleum effects either way. So Linton was torn down. They let them keep a tiny sliver of mixed-use buildings. And one man who, Hammer Steel, owns the entire riverfront land. He tears down old historic homes. He won't let the people of Linton have any access to the river. So one of the laws that exists is that people in Oregon have a right to the river. And in all of North Portland, if you were to go from the Broadway Bridge up to Sovies Island, we have one park, which is Cathedral Park. Cathedral Park is home to many houseless people. The water, the fish are contaminated. You have signs up that say you can't eat the fish. They'll poison you. Many, many people are sick. We asked last year Portland Parks if we could raise money for a playground, and they said no. We asked in Linton if we could have a mural to honor the indigenous history on that river as a counter story to the tanks. And ODOT said no. So they are locked in to saying that we will keep this industrial. And even though they have things about climate change, they do not budge. For the people who live in Linton and St. John's, we see them as unyielding. They wouldn't let a daycare center be started in the Catholic Church because it was industrial. So it goes on and on, the fight with City Hall.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today we're talking about Portland Sacrifice Zones with Sarah Taylor, who's a longtime resident of the Linton neighborhood, which is kind of at the northwest end of Portland, sandwiched between the industrial Riverside and Forest Park. And she's been an advocate for the lost history of Portland Sacrifice Zone for a long time and a leading voice in talking about what to do about this Superfund site that is also endemic to this area. First, I want to talk about how did this area get basically designated as a sacrifice zone?
Well, there are people who are urban planners who actually believe in that philosophy. They believe that it's better to take everything that's a polluting thing and put it in one neighborhood. They actually believe in that philosophy. I mean, I've talked to good people who were urban planners who believe that. Right now, that area has all your sewer. So if you're in Portland, all your sewer has gone to that area. 95% of all the gas in your car, in your home, in your stove is in that area. When they pick up your garbage every day, it always goes to that area.
Well, actually, doesn't it go to that area on its route?
Metro, yeah. It goes. But the Metro Transfer Center. And then for years, the St. John's Dump, which I guess was just an open dump. The oil trains doing whatever they are doing all the time are just up and down. To get gas to your car, they have to come pick up the gas and drive it all over the state of Oregon. So they've kind of taken everything that's toxic and put it in one place. Fortunately for us, unfortunately for them, there is a federal Superfund law that says, you know, you have to clean up the river. And most, I don't know the percent, but a large percent of the potentially responsible parties in the Superfund are petroleum-based, one way or the other. And, of course, it's Port of Portland, it's City of Portland, it's Northwest Natural, it's many people. They've been dragging their feet. And I think those of us who really want to see this cleaned up see that it's not just about cleaning up the sediments. It is about getting rid of fossil fuels that are especially export, not even looking at what do we need for our own lives and then let's cut back. Not even that, not even a plan. Like they just wrote the 2035 comprehensive plan, and there was no plan in that plan to limit fossil fuels in that area. There was no plan really to make sure that there's equal access to parks and that children are safe. Because you have to understand, James John Elementary School is less than a quarter of a mile from an liquefied natural gas tank. It's right on the river, right across from St. John's, right in Linton. So nothing in the comprehensive plan to deal with how unsafe the children and the people are of North Portland.
Actually, a really good friend of mine taught at James John's for a really long time, and she told me heartbreaking stories about some of the kids she taught second grade. And I actually didn't realize until just now where that school was. I just knew it was somewhere in North Portland. And I think from what we were talking about before we went on the air about the damage that these pollutants do to kids, it sort of explains some of the real dysfunction that she was facing. And yep. These were kids, they were only second graders, so you could think about how much worse it would get as they got older.
Yeah, what happened was that we had all this industry. You need to know that, you know, harsh chemicals were produced there, and a lot of chemicals are in the air, in people's bloodstreams, and they do pass down to children. It's not true, and they do pass down. And so people love to talk. I was a school principal about generational poverty, and I have come to believe that generational poverty is actually environmental poverty. I don't believe that it was. The people in North Portland were always hardworking. They fished for their own fish. They had gardens. They were taking care of themselves. And I think that when you begin to poison people's food, their water, their air, take away their jobs, bulldoze down their houses, that causes a deep community depression. And right now, people can drive through St. John's and say, oh, isn't it getting cute? But there are many of the housing areas that existed in World War II are still there. We still have John's Woods. We still have New Columbia. So what they've done and what they did before is they put the housing projects in between the Columbia River and the Willamette River. They're almost always in food deserts with horrible public transportation. And I'm not saying they haven't fixed them up and they didn't do some brilliant things, but these people are living in the sacrifice. So,
but there is a green zebra in North Portland now.
There is. So that's everybody says, well, there's a green zebra. So therefore the industry on the river and the air pollution, if you look at any map, the air pollution in North Portland is the worst, you know, and if you look at cancer maps, if you look at any health-related map, the people in North and, Northwest, they've pretty much torn down almost all the houses. But there are still some houses.
Well, actually, I lived in Northwest about 40 years ago, I guess. And I lived right at the edge of Industrial Northwest. Well, I lived on a street that used to have houses. And now where my house was is an on-ramp to the new on-ramp to the Fremont Bridge. But I was living just about a half a block from Vaughn Street. And that's when I discovered Esco, which I would smell, particularly on Saturday nights. And that's another interesting thing. I've talked to other people who lived in industrial zones. And Saturday night is when they really crank up the pollution. And it was really an eye-opener for me because I'd always lived either in southeast Portland or out up towards Mount Hood. So living in this industrial zone, I really questioned what I was doing there, what it was doing to my health. And yet I was like six blocks from Forest Park. So this to me is the big contradiction of Northwest Portland.
Yeah, and I think that, for Forest Park, all I can say is that the city of Portland needs to change the zoning to mixed use right along the park. Like if they have to do battle with the petroleum companies, that's one thing, but that zoning right on the park should not be flammable, and they should stop tearing down the historic little tiny historic homes that are up in that river, up in that forest. I just know that the Linton community was just told that they were targeted as one of the highest risk for a fire community in the country. And it's easy to see they have Forest Park with very little budget for cleaning out dead debris, and it was logged. And then they have highly, highly flammable, multiple flammable things right next to a park.
Well, we saw,
and it's an earthquake zone. So
it was not that many years ago that this truck that was carrying asphalt, I think, which plowed off the, you know, went off the road, hit an empty oil or an oil train that was not carrying oil at the point, burst into flames, and actually it seared all the signage on the highway. It closed down Highway 30 for hours. I was actually going to a party that night in Soviet Island. I had to go through St. John's to get there. It was a very intense experience, and it was a good indication of what would happen. It was a small indication of what would happen if an oil train actually caught fire. And that was before the Mosher fire. So I think it was maybe 5 years ago. And I'm thinking, why haven't we learned lessons about that? Because I remember Dan Sears was on the news from Columbia Riverkeeper, and he was talking about how this is an indication of why we shouldn't have oil trains going through Portland or any place. And yet I don't see any movement to really deal with this incredible risk that's right there.
There are more oil trains in Highway 30 and Linton now than there ever have been before. And, you know, there might be multiple reasons why, but their increase is huge. There's a daycare center, the Linton Community Center, and they park flammable trains in back of a daycare center. And there's just so many flammable trains. The Linton Neighborhood Association invited the people of Portland to the fire community, all different people, to come and speak after the accidents. And they said, you never contacted us. We were never alerted. What were you thinking was supposed to happen to us? And they just kind of like took notes and didn't do anything. And you need to know there's no fire company in that industrial zone. There's a little fire boat, but by and large, there's no fire company. And they say, well, all those companies will be their own fire company, or St. John's, the little firehouse in St. John's, will come and be the fire company. So we in Linton all believe we're all on our own. And they've kind of told us, you're on your own if things blow up.
Well, actually, there was a fire in the the North Escarpment of the Willamette River, right by University of Portland, a number of years ago, started by Burlington Northern, by Union Pacific. And I remember it was the residents who put the fire out with their garden hoses. So, yeah, that to me is an indication of just how ill-equipped. And a grass fire started by a train is a lot less of a catastrophe than an oil fire started by an oil train.
Oh, yeah. And Schnitzer caught on fire. And they couldn't get in to put the fire out. They had the wrong gate. And I mean, it was like a big to-do. And they said they have improved now, but pretty scary.
Well, actually, I was thinking about how I got, why I decided to call you to be on the show. And it started because I've been spending a lot of time in Tacoma for the past year working on one of the many fracked gas projects that's being proposed for the Northwest, this being the LNG facility in the port of Tacoma. And my friends that I was staying with were looking up, they were trying to figure out where the LNG came from that feeds the LNG peak shaver in Gig Harbor. And they came upon this old map of the port area in Portland and discovered that there was a LNG refinery in Portland. So that was my news, that there was actually an LNG refinery in Portland. And just a few months earlier, I'd been driving out to a friend's place near Sylvie Island, and I had this kind of very intense guy in the back seat who knows everything about the port area and the Superfund site and has all these historic photographs. And he was pointing out to me each one of these facilities, and a lot of it's Northwest Natural Gas. So the two things came together in my mind. And at which point I talked to Jan Zuckerman to see what she knew about all of this, and she suggested I talk to you. But I thought about how much we just take this sacrifice zone for granted if we don't live in it. And it makes me wonder, you know, we are so proud of Portland passing an infrastructure ban on future fossil fuel expansion and all the other things that Portland is noted for. Yet we have this, it reminds me of that story by Ursula Le Guin where this kid is locked in a basement and everybody else is happy in the town. And I kind of feel like that's the role that North and Northwest Portland play.
Yeah, I mean, if you drive, all you have to do, I mean, I'm happy to go anytime to give people tours, but if you just walk across the St. John's Bridge, which people do all the time, and you just look down to the south, you'll see the LNG tank. And I think most people don't know what it is. It's just a blue tank that's been there for a long, long time. And if you even question Northwest Natural, they'll just kind of hem and haw. And, you know, they've done a great publicity campaign for many years, convincing everybody that there's something called natural gas. And what natural gas really means is just that it comes from the earth, which could be every petroleum product.
And now it's fracked gas, actually.
Yeah, it's fracked gas. And of course, it's true that some gas was on the top of the earth and people could burn it like for thousands and thousands of years. But that's not what we have. And I know from going across that bridge almost daily that they've expanded. So I don't know what the infrastructure rule really means, because they have expanded like their footprint. I don't know what they're doing down there. I try to ask. But if you look up their corporate report, you know, they've spent millions of dollars to increase fracked gas in Portland, Newport, and then in Mist. If you were to look at a map, you would see that all of those are near proposed export places. So Williams Pipeline is a huge international pipeline corporation. I mean, it's just huge. And they supply Portland with gas. It comes from, you know, Canada. It comes from the South, and it's just huge. They are a for-profit company. Our gas is not a public utility. They went on the New York Stock Exchange. Their obligation is to make money. So their obligation is not to create a better, cleaner Oregon. It's to make money for their shareholders. Had they not become a share on a stock market, maybe they could have had a different mission. But they have a tank right in the Linton neighborhood, right across from St. John's. They have new infrastructure in Mist, which is right across from Klamath. And they're hustling. No one should not think that they're hustling and that they asked to be excused from some of their obligation to clean up the river. And the reason why they asked that was to save millions of dollars for their stockholders, but also so that they could build more infrastructure.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today about Portland sacrifice zones in North and Northwest Portland with Sarah Taylor, who's a longtime resident of the Linton neighborhood and an advocate for the lost history of Portland sacrifice zone. So let's get back to that lost history for a bit. How did it become possible for this area to just be written off and just to become the sacrifice zone? I mean, Portland is noted for having like pretty stringent zoning regulations compared to Washington State. And there's a lot of protections for neighborhoods. But what happened to North and Northwest Portland?
Well, I just think that early industrialists, you know, bought it. And you have to remember, we also have eminent domain. So the Port of Portland, the City of Portland created, and the governor's office created a non-elected Port of Portland board, which you must know in Vancouver, it's elected. In Portland, it's a nomination. So the Port of Portland is allowed to go and take people's land away from them. So when they create the Port of Portland as it stands now, they had every right to take people's land. So all they had to do was go up to people and say, this is for the economic benefit of the area, so we're taking your land. The other thing is that the Willamette River was never deep enough to be an international port, never. I mean, they decided, like, we're going to make it be a port when it probably should have been Astoria or, but definitely not the Willamette River, that was a tidal river that was never very deep. Like I said, well, Giles Lake's only 6 feet deep, someone told me, and they said, well, the river was probably 6 feet deep too. So, but they decided to dig it out, and they got a federal mandate to keep that channel open. Well, when they dug it, they had to do something with the dirt. So the easiest thing to do with that dirt was to dump it into that area. And if you owned that area, then they just took it from you. So the people in St. John's love to tell me a story, whether it's true or not, but that there was all these berry farms down where the Toyota yard is, and that the guy said, I'm not selling it. It's been our family for generations. And they came down and they shot his dog, and they said, and many people told me that story. So they roughed people up. This was not pleasant, the taking away of people's lands in North Portland, and it goes on today.
Well, you mentioned that the Port of Portland is not elected. It's appointed by the governor, basically.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I actually had forgotten that, and it was reinforced. I was just down in Southern Oregon in Coos Bay and North Bend and following the Pacific Connector Pipeline last week. And I was told by people in Coos Bay about the problem with the Coos Bay port is that it's appointed by the governor. Because I was saying, well, why don't you just elect good port commissioners like they did in Vancouver? And so when Jody McCaffrey told me that in Coos Bay, I was like, oh, that's true about Portland, too. How do we, because it seems to me that if the port commissions were elected, as we're seeing in Vancouver, and there's a transformation happening in Vancouver, Washington now, because the port commission is now 2-1 people who at least believe in climate science and also are really trying to stop the fossil fuel industry from getting a foothold there. If we were, what would it take for us to have elected port commissions in the state of Oregon?
I'm assuming that you can go to the legislature. And I guess what I would say from learning this history is that it's good to take on certain things like Northwest Natural or Zenith or different things. But ultimately, the area, people have to own the history, because you don't displace 100,000 people from Albina up to Linton and St. John's and just act like it never happened. And I just want to make sure I tell you, there's a story that I feel really attached to. I think we just get the legislature to change that.
Just get it like that?
No, I think we have to. I think that as we advocate against for climate change, for changing that, for stopping that, we also advocate for the infrastructure that made this possible. And in Portland, it's a city council that's not representative. Has there ever been a city council representative from North Portland? I don't think so.
But we do have one from the east side now.
From the east side,
so we'll work
at least.
I mean, I'm actually the most sanguine about the Portland City Council, and it might just be because I love Joanne. But
and it might change.
But I feel like when she got elected, and I mean, I had friends who were saying, how can she possibly get elected? The police will make sure she doesn't get elected. Well, something's really in the air that's different, that she won by such a wide margin, too. So I think we look at that and go, how do we get more city council people like that and have it be, well, the one idea is district elections.
Which is what normally you would have. And then they would have had somebody like looking out for them. Yeah. They also, when you think of neighborhood associations, the Northwest Industrial made their own neighborhood association. They left Linton and created one. So there are no houses. They kind of created not a real neighborhood association, which is fascinating. But I just want to tell one story is that when there was that African-American housing community on the other side of the railroad tracks over Kittredge Bridge, the school was right on Highway 30. So if there's that V, you're coming from Montgomery Ward down Old St. Helens Road, which is where Giles Lake was, and that was the school. The firehouse is still there. It's being gutted. And it's for sale, but that is the old Giles Lake Firehouse, the only thing I know that exists. Behind it was the school. So this young boy, was helping children cross the train tracks. And as he was going back to get more kids, he was killed by a train. And I personally, they're supposed to make a Forest Park Center right there in the industrial area, and I want that park to be named after that boy. And I think people opposed that park and said, well, it's ugly. And I just want to say, this is Portland's chance to own its history. Let this be the gateway to Forest Park. Tell the story there of the indigenous people, of the immigrant communities, and make that be the gateway. Don't give up on that dream and name it after that little boy that was run over by trains in Northwest Portland.
Well, I think there's a part of Portland that is starting to own its history. I mean, I find it interesting that Portland's sordid racist history and the rise and the domination of the Ku Klux Klan back in the 20s was even mentioned on a national TV show that was supposed to take place in Portland last year. And certainly, I mean, every event that I go to now that's from the center left on to the left makes some. The beginning of the event is always naming the tribes whose homeland we're basically occupying right now. So there's definitely some acknowledgement of the past and an effort to try to really embrace the past. I think some of it still feels kind of forced and is not always real comfortable when it's being done. I find it interesting that people who are very, very conscious to acknowledge the tribes that whose land we are on don't know about the history that you're talking about of North and Northwest Portland. So do you have any thoughts about how to bring this into the conversations that we're having about understanding all the dynamics of Portland and that Portland is not just this wonderful green fairy land that a bunch of liberals live in, but that it has a very diverse history and has a lot of diversity of people that has been ignored and forgotten and in some ways wiped out?
Well, I give tours. I'm giving a tour to a school group. Of course, it's the school that, you know, I was once the principal at.
This is the Sunnyside Environmental
School. Yeah, so they're gonna do an industrial sanctuary tour with me. But Lincoln went this year, and I am going to pass out flyers and do tours, which is probably my favorite thing to do because people stand in Cathedral Park or they stand up on the bluffs at U of P and they go, whoa, or I take them into the other side of Linton, and they go, whoa, what happened here? And then I don't know. You know, we tried really hard. We had a talented artist, Toma Villa, that was going to do the history of canoes on the river in Linton, and we're still hoping that ODOT will give in and let that story be told because it is really embarrassing that if you were a stranger coming to Portland, you would be hard put to walk around and see anything of our indigenous history. You tell me where you would find it. It would be really, really hard to find.
You know, it was really strange. Last summer, I went up to the canoe journey that landed in Tacoma on Puyallup land. And about a week before I was going up, I was at the beach on the Willamette in Selwood, and this canoe came up that looked just like the canoes I was going to see in Tacoma the next week. And there were two white people and a native guy that were in it. And it turns out that the indigenous person who owns the canoe actually does tours up and down the Columbia and the Willamette. I don't remember where he was from. But it was this weird kind of ghost of the past, even though I don't think that the canoe journeys were the same. I mean, this was much more of a Salish Sea kind of tradition than what we have on the Columbia Basin. But it still really struck me as like I'm seeing our past, like sort of emerge out of the Willamette River onto this beach, which is usually just the dog beach. And it was a glimmer of like what we need to find out more about.
Yeah, well, we don't like our parks, like Cathedral Park. I don't know. They just, even Sobeys Island, where we know there were villages, there's nothing. I mean, we just haven't done that. And that ODOT so firmly turned us down as part of our work. Part of the work of the Superfund communities is to undo that harm, not just to dig up the sediment, but to undo the harm done to the impacted communities. And the impacted communities are many elder people in that community. They're the people who worked in the factories, the people who worked in the shipyards, the veterans. I mean, North Portland is filled with impacted people, and no one wants to hear their story. You know, their story, it's a hard story. It's painful. And people mostly just want to say North Portland is kind of poor.
Well, it's kind of interesting because they can't even agree on how to dig up the sediment, you know, what real remediation for the Superfund site is. And it seems like the EPA, the skeleton of the EPA that we now have under the Trump administration, is trying to do as little as possible. But, I mean, that's been another issue that we can't even honestly remediate that. And how do we, beyond being able to dig up the sediment and figure out what to do with it and how to clean up the river again so that it's a healthy river, how do we do the same thing for people's lives?
Well, I think we listen to their stories, which is what I try to do. I try to go to places like walk along the river, go to the old restaurants, you know, go to the union, just go and listen to their stories. And then I try to share them with people. And then I think that as the river is cleaned up, as the fossil fuels must leave the area, because first of all, we have to stop having this level of fossil fuels. We can't pretend that natural gas is a true bridge fossil fuel. Like it's not going to work. And as those lands become empty, you know, to include community people in what becomes of that land so that we don't just sell it the same story over again, only this time we're selling it to developers to make big condominiums. So that's part of my tour when I'm going to be working with students this week, is to show that, you know, what they'll do is, again, sell it to a big developer. So first they sell it to a railroad baron, then they sell it to a petroleum, you know, fossil fuel baron, you know, and so it's just one sale after the other. And the way to undo the harm is to ask the community truly, truly, what do you want done with this land that was so wounded? You know, how do we heal this land? Now, we have community committees. And, you know, in theory, they're supposed to be listening to us. You know, that is what's supposed to be happening.
You're talking about the neighborhood associations?
Well, and the EPA has, and the city of Portland, they all pay people to do outreach and to listen to people, but does it translate into something happening? And it's a little bit frustrating because obviously what's happening at Zenith, what's happening at Northwest Natural Gas does not feel like anybody's listening to the people in those river communities. And I like to call them historic river communities, that they are our history. They are some of the oldest places in the official city of, you know, the city of Portland, in quote. And so I think that they just need to be included and to think about what they're going to do with that land and not to sell it to the first developers. And there should be more parks. And certainly Cathedral Park exists, could have historical information better than it has, and certainly could be safe. There's arsenic in the sand at Cathedral Park. The only park in North Portland has arsenic in its sand. And so we asked if we could make an alternative place for children to play. And the city of Portland said, absolutely no. So certainly those are small things that they could do right now. And then they could stop continuing to pollute. I mean, they could stop. Like, they don't have to allow Zenith. They can rezone. That area can be rezoned. And you don't vote for rezoning, just to let you know. They have a planning and sustainability board. They can get that out, and they can change the zoning for Zenith. They can say, if you haven't, you may not pollute the river anymore. They don't have to give DEQ permits to pollute the river.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about Portland Sacrifice Zones with Sarah Taylor, who's a longtime resident of the Linton neighborhood and an advocate for the lost history of Portland Sacrifice Zones. So I was just at a meeting last week about the planned expansion of the Zenith Energy oil by rail terminal. Most people in Portland probably don't know that there's an oil by rail train terminal in Portland, and that it could become big, and this could be, I don't think it would be quite the scale of the one that was proposed in Vancouver, but it could be a really increased oil train traffic in Portland and across the region. And there was somebody from the county commission. I discovered she's actually my commissioner, and she seemed to be a really wonderful person. And there was nobody from the city on the panel, but there were certainly city people there. And we got this feeling that, well, the city and the county don't have any way to really officially, or there's nothing in place that gives them the authority to stop Zenith from the expansion. And there were some very interesting ideas being thrown out about requiring insurance bonding and things that could be, the insurance that could be so expensive if it were really to cover the cost of the worst case catastrophe, that would stop it right in its tracks. But it seems that you're saying that the city of Portland, even though the infrastructure, fossil fuel infrastructure ban is not in place yet, it won't be in place in July, and the permit for Zenith Energy's terminal is 6 years old, so it would predate that and be grandfathered in. You're saying that the city of Portland has the authority to stop Zenith's expansion as well as maybe reining in Northwest Natural?
I don't know. I mean, I've tried to talk to them about it, but I believe that they can change zoning. I've never heard that they can't change. They change zoning all the time. There's like a retirement home, like for really poor people in the environment and in the industrial sanctuary. They just walked up to those people and changed their zoning overnight. So if they can try to zone out a retirement home, I'm sure they can zone out Zenith.
I'm thinking about just the political realities. Like my neighborhood, and I think most of Portland 20 years ago, 25 years ago, went through a whole planning, envisioning thing. And we, you know, there was a Portland 2040 plan, and we went through a whole decision-making process in our neighborhood association about how we were going to be zoned. And people, like, particularly did not want to be upzoned. And so there was a lot of fighting just on the part of residents and property owners, small property owners. So I'm thinking that if you were going to try to rezone the industrial area, there'd be an awful lot of fight back from Northwest Natural and Zenith and the other fossil fuel companies.
Of course there would be fight back. And there would maybe they would take you to court. And I'm not saying that, but I think that you can look at the Oregon land use law and say, for sure, we're going to have employment zones. Whether every employment zone should be in the same place isn't really good for the climate either. It should be, as they're doing, you know, more on where there's public transportation. But you don't have to say that there's no business down there, because there's lots of businesses down there that don't pollute the river, don't pollute the air, and are not flammable. Like, there are those kind of businesses down there, plenty of them. So those businesses can keep doing exactly what they're doing. So if you go from heavy industrial to industrial, like, you don't have to change everything. You can just change some of the zoning laws to say, we're not going to have a lawless area. Basically, an industrial sanctuary, they're keeping you safe from any environmental expectation. You are allowed to pollute. And for a long time, you know, people didn't complain. Then the mother with ESCO complained and started Neighbors for Clean Air. You know, University of Portland began to take notice, you know, so they weren't as isolated as they thought they were. They tried to create this isolated area and say, and then they just tried to bulldoze everybody else down. So I think that they can switch slowly. They can switch to industrial and see what that does. They can switch to mixed use. Like if you're a warehouse, you're fine still with mixed use. You don't have to go until you sell. Like the way zoning works, though, I have to say, is that that's your zoning when you sell. It doesn't change what you do today, but it definitely gives the fossil fuel community a different message that, you know, we're not going to do this forever. This isn't going to go on.
Well, another big question is that, as you mentioned earlier, all the gas that we use in our cars is being stored down in Linton. And just about every other fossil fuel that the natural gas or frack gas that we use also is being stored down there. Where are we going to put it? There's been a lot of talk, first of all, that it's the craziest place in Portland to have it stored because it's such a seismically active zone and it's liquefaction zone. But where do we put it? We're going to just move it further inland into like North Portland, or are we going to move it downtown, or is there a way to get rid of it?
Well, in my view, like let's just take Linton. They had a box factory. Well, it burnt down. So there was manufacturing jobs that really did employ people. And we all know that you employ a lot of people to make one of those places, but you don't employ a lot of people now. So these aren't great employment zones because they're not telling you, they say how many acres are employment zones versus how many people are employed. Well, in Linton, probably the 7-Eleven employs more people than Kinder Morgan. I mean, in Linton. So it's not true. So I think that you first of all sort out. What I would do is I would change the zoning. And then I would say, in this fossil fuel zone, what do we need for Oregon? For Oregon. Like no exports, just like what do we absolutely need? And that means Northwest Natural also not trying to encourage people to put more and more gas into their home when they know there's a limited number of years of having it. Like if we don't have a lot of natural gas left, then let's just be more, conserve it better if that's what we're going to use. So I think being honest about what we need, like what do we need? Do we need, how much propane do we need to have a summer grill in Portland? Like what do we need? So I would assess what we need, change the zoning, and then I would say to different communities in Portland, just like with electricity, you want gas, you're going to have a pipeline into your community. You're going to have some kind of a tank, but it will be one tank.
It's supposed to 15. Right?
And it's supposed to hundreds and hundreds because they're underground and above ground. And what do you want to do? You want to go for solar in your community? You want to go for wind? Or do you want to do electric cars? What do you want to do? Or you are going to have a smaller gas tank in your community that's going to supply your part of the state. And, you know, and for sure, the people who are trying to get the gas tanks off the fragile area by the river, they believe that it has to just go to a better area. But if it went to a better area, they wouldn't be that whole area, wouldn't go. You know, it would probably be just enough for our needs. And then to say you'd lose jobs, well, you will lose jobs, but you're going to lose a lot more jobs if Forest Park catches on fire or you destroy the Columbia and Willamette Rivers. So it's just not a valid thing. It's just a culture of that, you know, petrochemical zone, and they just want to hold on to it. And City of Portland just has to say it's just not good for our city or our climate.
Well, I was thinking this morning about how important it is to know where your garbage goes, and that's been one of my missions for about the last 20 years. But I'm also thinking about how it's really important to understand where your energy comes from. Now, in our neighborhood, there is an electric relay station. It's about 15 blocks from my house, maybe a little closer. It has had a couple big fires. And when it has the fires, we lose our power, and people realize that's where our electricity, the last link before it comes into our house. So it gives you more of a connection with where your electricity comes from. having a gas tank in your neighborhood could be a lot more frightening and would maybe make people think, do I really need to have all this gas? I mean, actually, I'm about to meet with a water heater person today to try to decide what to do about a new water heater. And this is something I've been thinking about, which
electric.
Is it's time to go electric. It may be more expensive, but it's more expensive. But I keep thinking about how much do I want to be contributing to all those tank farms down in Lytton, and do I want one in my neighborhood? So these are things I'm thinking that we need to think about.
No, I think people, I wanted to do a brochure and tell people, you know, when it comes time, make the switch. And I have a son that lives in Europe, in Sardinia, and they push them to have nothing to do with gas. Like they just do not want to be gas dependent at all. Just remember, Northwest Natural has put millions of dollars into the Mist gas tanks in the middle of a clear-cut forest, and that is
in Mist, Oregon. You're talking about
Mist, Oregon, to support electricity. So if you don't click, I want wind and solar, your electricity is actually coming from fracked gas, which is a humbling thought. And I drove out there for fun, and it is sitting in the middle of the biggest forest fire danger. It was just mind-boggling.
Well, on this note, I'd like to invite you to do a tour, which we'll do, and we'll broadcast it on Locus Focus in May. So at some point, we'll hopefully in maybe 6 weeks or so, we'll do this show live from the Sacrifice Zone.
Okay, sounds good. And I'll let you know, and you can put it on your website when I'm doing my next tour.
Right. Be great. Well, thanks a whole lot for joining us, Sarah.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for listening.
Well, we've been talking with Sarah Taylor, a longtime resident of the Lytton neighborhood and an advocate for the lost history of Portland's Sacrifice Zone. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll be talking with Kevin Jennings, author of The Grand Food Bargain, and we'll be in Pledge Drive, so remember to become a member. My engineer is Ketsey Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Marvin Gaye. Thanks for listening.
On the oceans and upon high seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be. Radiation underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby are dying. Mercy, 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 please. All things and what they...